Hello and welcome to this Cloud of Data podcast with your host, Paul Miller. I have been following the emerging data market space for a number of years, trying to understand the ways in which some of the companies who are beginning to appear there relate to one another and how they offer a value proposition to customers. During this series of podcasts, I'm going to be talking to stakeholders from a number of the leading players in the data market space: Microsoft, Factual, Kasabi, InfoChimps, and a number of others. Each of these podcasts will be made available on the Cloud of Data website, as well as through iTunes and perhaps a number of other syndication routes. Please feel free to check back from time to time as new episodes become available. In this fourth episode, I talk with Flip Cromer, co-founder of InfoChimps. Flip variously describes InfoChimps as a SourceForge for data or an Amazon for data. In this conversation, we explore both of these ideas and some of the ways in which InfoChimps is being used. Flip, thank you very much for joining me for this podcast today. Before we get into the detail on data markets and InfoChimps, can you tell listeners a bit about yourself and your own background, please?
Sure. I was in CS and then in physics, and I'd actually kind of started moving towards physics education and in grad school, and really thinking about how to make rich information streams, you know, massive information collections accessible to non-experts, basically make it so you didn't have to go to grad school in CS and physics to be able to do, to do the stuff that only an expert in another domain could do, right? If you're a public health expert, you can't also get a degree in machine learning, but you're the person that can make sense of that data. So out of that, you know, I would kind of started building tools to make data easier to use, but as I would play with data, I would, you know, find these awesome data sets, make them useful, and wanted to put them where other people could get at them and collaborate on them. There's no such thing as a source forge for data. So as a weekend project, you know, kind of said, oh, I'll just try building one. People really liked the idea, including my two co-founders, and it spiraled out of control. And, now it's a few years later, and we've made some major strides in that direction.
So, SourceForge for data.
That's how it started.
And is that how you would describe InfoChimps today?
So one of the realizations we made early, the key thesis to what we're doing is that getting disparate kinds of data, getting data that crosses knowledge domains together, makes the data explosively more powerful. I can describe that in more detail. But that, you know, we think that there's a real network effect of data with data. So that the best thing for a data commons and the best thing for a data marketplace is to have them together, to make it so that there are pure incentives for people to gather and refine and analyze knowledge. And so what we've developed is basically, if you want to put data up for free, we'll share it for free. We'll host it. We'll make it so that people can get it. If you are a data vendor, you can put data up at a price you set, license you set, and, works like an app store. We make it available to people. And the fact that they're together in the same place means that whether it's for love or money, the data becomes greatly more valuable, and we're already seeing some of the ways in which it does so.
That's an interesting premise, that by pulling data together, it becomes more valuable. You know, I guess the whole is greater than the sum of the parts would be the idea. Carry on.
So, yeah, and you know, all right, so the way I've been thinking about it is that there's a, we're trying to drive a phase transition in the network graph of these data sets. So rather than try to explain that right now, let me come back to the, like, I think much more straightforward picture, you know, that we think of it now. Okay, so why is it that you want data, right? We're a data marketplace, but what we actually sell is context. Basically, you have data that you've gathered. This is the, you know, whether it's visitors to your site, results of your polls, whatever it is, the data that you, our customer or user, have is useful but incomplete because you don't have the context you need to bridge the gap from data to insight. So the value of the data comes in providing the variables that explain what's going on, in saying, you know, you can measure the IP, you can find out the IP addresses of all the visitors to your site, but if you're a campaign site, you can't speak about the issues that are important to that visitor based off just off that. If you can take those, turn it into a geolocation, turn a geolocation into demographic variables, or you can turn an IP address into, you know, is this person work in the banking industry? Then you can talk to them about the issues that are important to them. Right? So it's that context that turns the stuff you can measure into the stuff you can act on. Now, thinking about, so context is why, you know, data drawn from all these diverse sources is relevant to customers. But if you also now think about it from our end, all those data sets sit there providing context for each other, right? Context is a catalyst that turns data into insight. Well, all these data sets that we're now being able to join to each other more and more fluently and more deeply, you know, are basically bathing in this context catalyst that every time we add a new one, it brings it to a, you know, higher boil. I can talk about some, you know, examples of where we see this.
Yeah. And I think we'll get to some of those examples in a moment. Yep. I guess you take data from one source, perhaps a market research company, and you take data from a political pollster or whoever it may be, and then you're taking data from a third source and pulling them together to create this insight. How do you set about quality assuring the data? How do you set about harmonizing the variables in the data so that you know they're talking about the same thing, so that you're actually comparing like with like?
Yeah. So let's see. So one of the things we thought at the very beginning was going to be incredibly important was provenance, was letting people trace back like every atom of the, you know, letting people trace back the data all the way back to reliable sources, establishing a trust chain. You know, we were sure that people, because me and my, the technical co-founder Dhruv both come from an academic background, we really thought that was going to be essential and put a lot of early thought into it. Then we watched people use our site. And, you know, kind of that information's fairly well available, at least to people's satisfaction. When you watch what they actually did, you know, the provenance and stuff wasn't actually that big a deal to people. And in fact, the normalization of it, right, getting it all so that it's you know, in a very, you know, very strictly common way, Freebase was, you know, kind of all about that, is incredibly costly, not that important, and somewhat of an, you know, impossible effort. Just think about all the different methodological approaches behind measuring something as straightforward as GDP, where, you know, you can't even get Congress and the White House to agree. You can't put those on a common footing. What you can do is put them in the same place. We call this adjacent data. So what we try to do is, you know, the same way Amazon doesn't try to package everything in the same package, they put it all out on a common marketplace and make it so that you can find out all the information that's available about a given reseller. You know, make sure that you can, you know what the form of the thing you're going to receive is, and then give you the choice to find out the thing that matches correctly. So as far as the normalization, we try to really stick to doing it as much as possible, at the syntactic level, at like bringing it to, you know, kind of common formats, rather than kind of, the fool's errand that a lot of the semantic web, frankly, is.
Maybe we won't go there right now.
I would like to.
Indeed.
I have some more concrete. I can say some more concrete, less bomb-throwing things on that. So,
and we've had that conversation before as well. I think it involved beer. I guess, you suggested there that there are different interpretations of things like, for example, GDP.
Sure.
And so you're suggesting that you can't have a single representation on InfoChimps of the one true definition of GDP. It is, though, isn't it still important to explain what the differences are, to explain the worldview under which a particular data set was formed, so that, for going back to your example of Congress and the White House, so that I'm not coming along from outside the US and taking a congressional data set and a White House data set and munging them together when actually they're not comparing like with like.
Absolutely. And we see actually this in kind of what customers want. One of the places where we've seen kind of the best evidence of a healthy, kind of marketplace evolving like we expect and are seeing is IP to geolocation data, right? IP intelligence data. On our site, we list on the one end, MaxFind has this IP to geographic mapping that they've released under an open license. It's basically a coarse-grained version of the, premium one that they sell. Incredibly useful, but it doesn't have the accuracy and it doesn't have the comprehensiveness that some of the commercial ones do, and it doesn't have a lot of the columns. All the way at the other end, on InfoChimps, we also sell data from Digital Element. This is probably the best IP to geo mapping out there. It's incredibly dimensional. It's very fine-grained. And it's very comprehensive. And it, the one was free. The other costs what we've seen is an affordable price that really unlocks things for developers. In the middle, we've got, we ourselves took the census data, which is just ferociously, very ferociously complex. There's 50,000, columns in there, and distilled it down to like the ones that are kind of the top line interesting ones. Combine that with an open, with the open IP to geo mapping, and we have that as, as a paid data offering. And what we find is that all of those are popular with customers, that the free data that we combine to make the very convenient IP to very rich demographics data set, people gladly pay for it even though it's right there next to it, a free alternative, and they gladly pay, other customers gladly pay for having the premier. It's branded, it's trusted, and I can read about why on the site data that's on lock.
So a lot of what's driving that decision is having adequate metadata around the content. So it's an informed decision rather than simply one based upon price.
And that is really the thing that we've found out is key. If I could point to the I believe I can say these are probably the two most important things for a data marketplace are basically metadata and making the data easy to use. are kind of the chief challenges. And that, yeah, that's what we've seen, is that the it's having rich metadata around the data is far more important than, for instance, things like you know, having it in a variety of formats, as long as the customer base is able to deal with, you know, kind of what they have.
So given the importance of metadata to a data marketplace, based upon what you just said, how much is ensuring the quality and completeness of that metadata your job, and how much is it your customer's job?
Right. So, you know, if I think about Amazon, in principle, it's the supplier's job. But we're smart and we're pragmatic, and so we do a lot to help, you know, make sure that they're rich. We're also, of course, sitting next to all the web analytics, and so, you know, kind of when a supplier lists stuff with us, we're able, because of the, you know, Google juice, because of the keyword traffic we get, to get data sets, you know, into the top Google listings. So it is good all around for us to help help suppliers get good metadata attached to their products.
And do you see that going through an iterative process? So, for example, where a data supplier comes to you with a good data set, but bad metadata, and it doesn't sell, they're recognizing the need to improve essentially the marketing of their content by describing it properly.
Yes. You know, it's one that, so you're seeing, you know, kind of, data fluency, you know, is just the, both the number and extent to which people are able to, you know, deal with data at serious scale and are hungry to consume data is growing. And so it's even rapidly evolving, like, you know, what people are looking for, how they search it, how you want to tell them about it. And, you know, so it's not just iterative with the supplier, it's iterative with the customer and the, you know, and the metadata, as in the data about what in the metadata is successful.
Yes. So how broad a set of data does InfoChimps take? You know, can you characterize the sorts of stuff you take, or is anything fair game?
Right. So I guess there's two directions, right? So the main one is, you know, like I said, our thesis is that it's disparate data sets. It's getting, connecting these knowledge domains together that are the most interesting. I mean, basically, if you've read Freakonomics, we're that on steroids. So we want to be taking data that spans knowledge domains. In some, we think a vertical focused approach is somewhat flawed. I mean, in some sense, like for the mature data industries, providing data is fully commoditized. It's a solved problem to provide financial data to financial services companies. They know exactly what they want the data to look like. There's companies that provide it, and they have the tools to deal with it. Same thing with geodata and the GIS industry. However, we demonstrate that there's a big need for, you know, to provide financial service, financial data to petroleum companies, geodata and social data, you know, business listing data, all the rest of this, both the connective tissue and the, you know, and the data meat to other industries that haven't been able to access the data. That's partly because of the availability of the data, partly because of new ways to connect it, and partly just, you know, things like open web standards, you know, things like JSON and XML, stuff like that are, you know, mean that things that used to look, if you think about like, you know, 15 prong, you know, big hairy pro style audio interconnect that making it instead look like the RCA cables you use to hook up your stereo, really democratizing access to the data at the syntactic, at the semantic, at the tool level.
And where does your data come from?
From the community, from government sources, from third-party suppliers, and, you know, probably I would say, though, the most interesting subset are ones that you get when you smash things together, especially when you can combine it with, you know, can kind of give it an underpinning of the this, you know, torrents of social data that's coming out there.
And to what extent are you doing that smashing at InfoChimps, and to what extent are your customers doing it?
To a largest extent, we are. And a large part of that, I think, is because, first of all, you know, we have the tool sets to do it, and we're sitting right next to it, so we can see what customers are demanding. That's as far as data that's listed. The great majority of the stuff that is, you know, different data sets in combination come from us. Of course, the way that our customers use it has largely been, you know, this was one of the interesting, I think, validating things, is not as much that they're getting the data just to use as the data, but that they're getting the data to use as context, so that the way that they are primarily using it is, you know, in some sense as a mashup of, say, their web analytics with, you know, things that give them audience insight.
And how are customers making use of the data that you provide to them on InfoChimps? Are they downloading it? Are they accessing it via an API? Or are they using it actually on your site?
They are largely using it through the API. And there's kind of I would say, two principal uses. So downloading it, I would say, especially kind of a lot of the commons data, there's just, you know, a broad long tail market. As far as, you know, like the commercial stuff, first of all, there are developers who largely use it through the, lightweight JSON, RESTful, et cetera, API we provide. And then there are people who are using it at extremely large scale, where they are integrating it in with, their large data flows, point of sale data, audience analytics, marketing data, and especially web logs, web analytics, whether it's real time or post hoc. And so there's kind of this, basically the set of people who are using it for fast, low latency online, in the middle of a web request or in the middle of their app, are using the API, and people using it at scale are using it, kind of more in bulk.
Okay. And do you have a feel for how many of those different user types would have got the data directly from the source in the past, and how many of them simply would have had to do without?
I hope I'm not flattering I hope we're not flattering ourselves if I say most of them would probably do without. I think the data is really hard to find. It's really hard to license. So a lot of the commercial suppliers we have are people who either sold data in, or a lot of them are people who kind of sold the data in bulk in large sales where they're selling the whole thing to a company, you know, for a license to use it. And what we, our pitch to them is, as opposed to like a mashery where you pay them and they implement an API for you, give us the data, we've got the API implemented, and we'll give you money, right? We'll give you the App Store cut when we sell your data. Paul, I've lost the thread of the question.
Well, I mean, let's follow the the point you were just on there around money. And you were suggesting there that contributors of data do so for free. There is no charge to put data into InfoChimps. Is that correct?
Right. Obviously, if you're a supplier, there's no charge to list it. We give you a commission when we take a commission when we sell it. You take home most of the money. And when you're putting data up on the commons for everybody to share, to collaborate, to learn from, etc., we make it free for you and free for anybody else who wants it.
Okay. And so the money comes when I choose to download a commercial data set, which has been listed for free, but I pay for the right to use it.
And that's right. And so that was where I was headed, is to talk about, the value proposition we're offering. So you pay for data, and if there's services offered on top of the data, you pay for the services. So the API comes with a tiered pricing model. If you're using it very few number of calls per month, it's actually free, so you can find out and get started. And we have people who use it, at the variety of paid levels up from there, where you're kind of paying by the number of calls, and corresponds to, the services we have to maintain. Also, if the data is commercial, you're paying for the data itself as well. And that's typically on a, this much money gets you, this many calls, and in a way that's, super lightweight, so that, basically we make it so that you don't have to deal with negotiating licenses, lawyers sending anything back and forth. You click the license agreement and the user agreement. We make the data easy to find because we've got a catalog. We make the data easy to use, and then it comes to you not just in, convenient form like JSON, whatever else you request, but actually so that the data is schematized so that it fits, fits regular patterns, so that things that are places all are shaped the same, but without insisting that they all are conceptually the same. And I think lastly, it's technically easy to use, in that the API is fast, it's easy to experiment with. There's a little explorer widget you can use on the site that shows you exactly what API calls to make. And I think it's in huge part that convenience that people have told us is a key value add, and is the biggest difference between them finding some other solution and using data through us.
Okay. And that value add, you would suggest, works if you want a single data set and if you want half a dozen.
Yeah. So this is one of the cool things we developed over the summer is, I don't know how familiar you are with Avro, which is, Doug Cutting, the inventor of Hadoop.
Yep.
Has been, basically took his giant brain and he looked at JSON, he looked at XML, he looked at the other data formats that were out there. But kind of baked into this is this realization that a procedure call, or RPC, right? Basically, API calls, so-called RPCs, the protocols you use to communicate with remote services, or even just procedure calls in your code, versus data formats, right? Like the way you serialize out data if you're going to send it to disk or over the wire, that those actually aren't different things. There's no difference. There's no important difference between like a MySQL create table statement, or a description of, an XML schema or what have you. And he's developed basically a data format called Avro, and it's now emerging as the underpinning of how big data components speak to each other. So it's the way that all the Hadoop infrastructure, they all communicate now over Avro protocols. In there, one of the things he's figured out is a really pragmatic way to describe the data. And we took that way of describing the data and combined it with the schema.org breakdown of types and classes. Basically, schema.org is a effort gotten together by Microsoft, Google, and a few other little Bay Area companies like that. And what they did was say, you know what, as opposed to like all the rest of the unruliness of the web and the difficulties in reconciling everything at a semantic level, can we just do the following? Can we agree that there is such a thing as a place? And that given that there's such a thing as a place, when we talk about its coordinates, it's going to be in a subfield called coordinates, where latitude is spelled all the way out and longitude is all spelled all the way out. And to a non-programmer, I don't know, this might seem like a minor detail. It makes the data incredibly more useful if you can just agree that at a syntactic level, that just we're going to call the fields the same thing all the time. And they developed this to make the web pages easier to scrape. We found that it was like a really nice, sensible way to, you know, say these are core concepts in the world, and we'll use those as the schema that we deliver data back to people with. And just a whole lot of, technical things become much easier when you do that.
So InfoChimps now supports schema.org?
And I should be clear, what we support is that our data models map fairly directly to the schema.org data models. We don't provide the data in the with the schema.org markup, just because most of our developers consume the data through JSON or XML. It's the actual micro formats described on schema.org are largely about marking up your HTML. I don't know. Sorry, if I dived there to a technical nitpick, but yeah, I mean, basically, when you look at a schema.org model for a florist or a social identity, that's pretty much what that concept will look like when you get it through InfoChimps.
Okay, and you could presumably use the schema.org markup in your metadata to make the metadata descriptions more visible to the search engines.
Yep. Yeah, and so there are, we call this ICSS, this combination of schema.org and InfoChimps Simple Schema. There is ICSS to describe ICSS. The snake eats its tail.
Yes, indeed. It's beginning to sound awfully like the semantic web flip.
So to be clear, so the big difference is, there's two big differences. One is trying to be very pragmatic about one of the things that is really essential to that is degrading nicely. So there are core concepts, but we don't insist on those. We just make it easy to conform to them. The other is actually staying away from the semantic part and really sticking to the syntactic part, that we're not enforcing that those concepts are actually compatible. We're saying it's up to you, the programmer, the developer, the user, the analyst, to understand whether they're compatible. We're just making it so that, where they are, where they're close enough, that they are easy to consume in combination.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Now, through that last piece of the conversation, you mentioned licensing a few times, I think mainly in the context of contributors giving you data and getting mm-hmm. getting away from the complexity of all the different licensing agreements.
Right.
So does InfoChimps then expose to customers a single license, or am I still going to have to sign all those slightly different variants that all the suppliers insist on?
There are, yeah, There are variables. And, you know, it's one of these, it's a reflection of, you know, when there's a common marketplace and common meeting ground, that stuff starts to straighten itself out. There isn't yet. So there's still a lot of Wild West aspects to it. A lot of them are fairly straightforward, though. Like, you know, to use the Foursquare data, you sign the Foursquare developer license agreement. And, you know, they don't generally, you know. But the fact is that different things are important to different suppliers. We also, I'm not really remembering having a customer kick up a fuss. There's so many thornier problems to deal with for a developer that kind of they're glad to find the data and the terms are generally reasonable. And we make it, I mean, it's, you click a button and you hopefully have read the agreement, but you click a button and you're ready to go.
Do people ever actually read the agreement?
Well, what was that South Park episode where terrible things happened to him because he had never read the iTunes, 40-page thing? I hope they are.
Okay. Presumably, it's one of the areas in which a marketplace can actually begin to have an effect. You know, if I'm having to go to 100 different sites to get 100 different data sets, I understand clicking 100 different agreements.
Right.
But once it all comes into one place, it's not a problem, but it begins to become an annoyance. And perhaps where there are choices of data sets, three different data sets of IP addresses mapped to Latin long or whatever it is, I might choose the one that has the least pain. That then becomes a market pressure on the data suppliers.
Absolutely. And, and I should say that a lot of suppliers actually find it really, you know, we have a license that, you know, basically, you know, some suppliers don't have anything like a standard license. And so we have one that they can choose to adopt. And then that's convenient because, you know, then you've agreed to it and then you don't have to click through. So there's even this other advantage to a supplier for adopting a standard license, which is that then there's no friction for a developer to try it out. There's no like, you know, oh, hey, I'm going to play around with this thing and, you know, oh, I got to look at this and I'll just leave it bookmarked. I'll go away. So there's also that incentive, less friction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess especially actually as you begin to move up to the developers working in larger organizations where they're probably not allowed to click a license anyway. They would probably have to send it to legal.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, like it's the, it's really, you know, the ones that have like the bespoke licenses are typically the big, you know, industrial strength, very, very interesting, but and high dollar ones. So, yeah. You know,
yeah. That brings me on actually to a question about the value of data. Clearly, there are some markets, such as financial markets, you know, where they pay their Bloomberg subscription without thinking about it. There are other markets where developers, I guess, have always just kind of assumed they can get the data for nothing. It's always just kind of been there and it's kind of been all right and it's maybe been almost fit for purpose. In those sorts of markets, and I guess especially as you begin to expand into new markets, how do you set about persuading people that the data they're using has a value and is actually something they should pay for rather than just download?
I don't know that we've actually done that much persuasion. We've just looked at what's hard for people and thus that they're willing to pay for and help bridge the gap. So one thing is services built on top of people are gladly paying for free data because we're providing services on top of it, like an API. They're gladly paying for the data to be cleaned up. So, I mean, the value proposition of Look, I can tell you how long it takes to make, the census data accessible to a non-expert, and it's to take, about three talented engineers and have them work for a full, summer on doing so. And a lot of developers get that, actually, instead of dealing with having to look up that table B5003A lists these variables in this universe and blah, 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 I would like to know what fraction of people have a college education in this zip code. The rates that we charge are very reasonable for that. Basically, there's services built on top of the data. Obviously, there's the quality reputation of the data. There's how difficult it is to acquire. There's making big data small. Certainly the most popular type of data we provide is data mined from the social networks, where we're taking insights from 7 billion tweets and turning it into, this is how often people discuss this topic, or these are the topics this, user has discussed in public. So making big data small is incredibly valuable. And making it technically useful, and then also making it kind of not just easy to use, but easy to understand. So doing stuff like taking the census data from the, thorny verbiage that you have there and just curating it to say, this is a good measure of income in a geolocation. If you're thinking about, are people rich or poor, you want to look at these particular numbers, and we've made them so that they're, phrased like we find people want to think about them.
Which isn't just a technical job. It's not a case of you computing that. It's not a case of, computer scientists attacking that. There's actually some economic knowledge needed there. So do you need to employ domain experts in all the domains you have data in?
Well, in that case, we actually have an information, UT has one of the best library science, information science schools in the world, and we have a really talented information engineer is her title. I think she's the first of, one of the first of what'll be a new profession, who helps curate and make those decisions. There is definitely a lot of domain knowledge in there, and there's no way that we as a startup or as proprietors of an open marketplace can or should apply that domain knowledge. What we can do is look at what people want, what people ask for, and look at what customers need and help them pull in the low-hanging fruit, consult with experts, consult with references, and find that out. But this is why, if you want the best IP geolocation data, buy Digital Elements stuff. Don't buy the stuff we made that puts next to it. There's a different value offering in the, the IP to demographic stuff that we have there. But in general, we don't and won't ever try to compete on quality, extent of domain knowledge, that kind of stuff.
So a lot of it comes down to the customer understanding what they need the data for. And it also sounds actually as if you're beginning to find that customers don't actually want to buy the data at all. They're wanting to buy insights and answers on top of it.
And so the way I phrase it is, is context. It's about the data joining to the data that they work with, that they know, that they love, that they understand. But what they don't have are the variables that explain what's going on. And, the things that bridge the gap from I want to, you know, if you want to help people choose a daycare, you know, their social identity or the name of a daycare place, those are data. They're not useful yet because they're just data points. Context would be, hey, here's all the listings from – here are all the, you know, state-mandated reviews from the Department of Child Services for all the daycares so that you can turn the name of a daycare into, you know, kind of what is their review record? Have there been complaints, et cetera? You can turn a social identity into – you know, how similar is this person's friends group to which set of Yelp reviewers so that I can target not just, you know, the consensus Yelp review, but the consensus relevant Yelp review. So, you know, it's about providing data in a form that is conceptually and technically compatible with how people are consuming data and how they think about it.
Which is far more valuable, but also far more expensive. Is it more valuable than it is more expensive, if you see what I mean?
Because so we think of, you know, coming back to the analogy of a knowledge graph, right, of all these data sets connecting, there are definite hubs, location, right, geospace, obviously time, social identity, business identity, topic and keyword, and so forth. These are kind of central things which a lot of other data sets very capably join onto. So you don't have to connect every with every. And you don't have to, like, sit there and stitch data sets together at the record level. You have to make it clear how these concepts can connect to the, you know, kind of central hubs and make it, you know, so don't try to reconcile, normalize, et cetera, all the columns. But if there's geolocation in there, put it in a common language that makes it so that a developer can just write one model that's able to understand a place, whether that place is a forest or a mountain, and make it easy for those to join on each other. So don't insist that, like, sometimes there's hours, minutes, seconds, you know, decimal degrees, etc. That transformation gets you so far along the way of making the data, you know, fluent and connectable. And there's another thing, which is that the data actually kind of our big bet is that when we get enough of this data in the same place, and we're starting to see it, the data is going to start wiring itself up. That rather than kind of putting in all the semantic stuff, you know, by hand at the start, that what you want to do is get a density of data together that there's so much evidence that a lot of the thorny problems start solving themselves. So think about entity resolution, right? This is where you need to turn some, you know, fuzzy reference to a place or a thing into some canonical, you know, representation of the thing, right? You know, turning Flip Cromer and Philip Cromer into the same thing, or turning, you know, St. Cloud, Minnesota, no matter how you're spelling Minnesota and Saint and all the rest of it, into the same place. So with 100 million Twitter user identities where people list where they are in whatever whimsical, factual, or careful or not careful way that they will, you can take all that and you can tie it back to ambient evidence of kind of where people are. And through that, what you can end up with is a data set that tells you where Wine Country or San Francisco, you know, or Red Sox Nation are by looking at what people do and the fuzzy, fuzzy ways in which they've referred to it. Let me parenthetically mention that, you know, when we're dealing with data like that, it's data that's publicly available that we're using through whitelisted means and protecting people's data. In this case, this is about exposing insight about what are the ways that people refer to place. That data set can now be used to clean up other messy data sets where, you know, new messy references, which formerly were noise, are now new ways to clean up that in future data sets. So get the data at enough density where either it's so many things joining on a common concept, or in these growing number of cases where you can enumerate every single example of a thing seen in the world, and a lot of formerly hard problems get simple, where simple means dealing with terabyte scale data.
So everything is solved by collecting everything.
let me make a less categorical statement. So the way Jeff Jonas, researcher at IBM, puts it is the solution to a too much data problem is more data.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Some of the time, most of the time.
An increasing amount of the time.
Yes. I can see all sorts of potential for that to go horribly wrong, but also plenty of cases where it will work just fine.
Sharp tools to small children is what we did.
Yes. Do you not feel a sense of responsibility doing this? A little knowledge is a dangerous thing sometimes.
Yeah, but it's hard to find examples where it hasn't overall been well in our balance to make it easy, you know, to really unlock data, unlock information for people, even where it does provide risks. I mean, you see it with a lot of the, you see it with all the Facebooks and stuff like this, where, you know, there's nervousness about the privacy, but there's also, you know, all the wonderful stuff that comes out of being able to connect with
you. No, absolutely. So we're almost out of time. There's just a couple more things I want to touch on before we wrap up. First, a question about branding. You're pulling in data from a lot of different sources. Some of those sources are household names, whether government or a commercial provider. How do you get the balance between projecting essentially an InfoChimps brand, I guess especially once you start to create these aggregations, and projecting the brands of the constituent data sets? So, you know, come to InfoChimps, we've got the US government census data. Or come to InfoChimps, we've got really good data about people.
Yeah. So, there's... the name InfoChimps kind of comes from, there's kind of two things in there. One of them, which I've touched on repeatedly, is, you know, this, if you get data from somewhere else, the way the world is now, you could be the most talented programmer in the world or a trained chimpanzee, and it's going to take you a day to make it useful at least. So one part of it is enabling the division of labor. The other part of it is kind of a little bit of a pun on the infinite monkeys theorem. This is basically the idea that, you know, look, what we're trying to do is, connect every public or commercially available pool of structured data in the world to a common platform. That's an audacious goal and one which, you know, like we can't do, humanity has to do it. To the extent you see us acting as suppliers of data, it's lead and get out of the way. You're going to come to InfoChimps to get, you're going to come to InfoChimps to get financial projections about companies done by people that's all they do. You're going to come there to get, you know, business listings from companies that have scoured every piece of evidence in the world for such a thing as a business and are giving you the contextual, the rich contextual information you need to understand, you know, all the edge cases and all the dimensionality that implies. And a lot of that comes with having branding, and it is best for us and suppliers when, you know, those brands are strong and promoted. So, you know, again, coming back to ourselves as the Amazon of data, you know, you go to Amazon to buy Levi's jeans and you understand what the Amazon brand represents, which is that that stuff will be delivered on time with superb customer service and at, you know, kind of the best available price. And you understand what the Levi's brand means, which is, you know, you'll look good and they'll stand up for years.
Okay. Yes, good. And finally then, all of these conversations in this series are about companies that are in one way or another are involved in the data market space. And data markets are something that analysts are talking a lot about. Does that make it a real category? You know, are you and all of these other so-called data market companies doing the same thing? Or is it just a convenient label for analysts that doesn't actually mean anything in the real world?
I think it's definitely a real thing. I think that there is there are several of us that I think we're all see the same mountain. We all think it's huge, Google huge, and we're climbing different faces of it. But I think we're all after the same thing, which is, you know, connecting the world structured knowledge together. You know, thinking about it like, you know, you'll in like Kabbalism, or, you know, you see this in fantasy novels, they'll talk about like the power of the true name of a thing. If coming back to that example of, you know, how you can use messy data at massive scale to know that San Francisco is really just the same thing as San Francisco, and in fact, how often. What Factual is doing, you know, when I was talking about like the content, there are these concept hubs of, you know, geo and social identity, business identity, stuff like that. At least from my outsider's view, what I see Factual doing is really trying to own those hubs, to be the place you go to find the true name of the thing, the one that actually gives you power to connect it to the rest of the knowledge graph. And so while right now you see them really just concentrating on business listings in a geographic context, so in some sense they might look like they're vertical, I strongly suspect that, you know, Gil and all of them are probably have in progress at least the next one of these concept hubs to move into.
And that, that was kind of what Tyler suggested in the first podcast in this series, yes.
Okay. And now Microsoft, I think if we're the Amazon of data, I think Microsoft is the Saks Fifth Avenue of data. They're going to be, right? So they're not going to be carrying, you know, they're going to say, this is the data set you use for this purpose, right? Where we're saying, this is the market of solutions for that purpose, right? Here are all the socks that all the different vendors wear. They say, these are the socks that they're wearing in Milan this spring. And so they are going to have, you know, kind of the chosen, you know, high-end data suppliers. They're also Microsoft. So, you know, the same way that for Google, they want data to be closed, or at least they want it to be open so that, you know, open for them so that it can be closed for them. But they want software and hardware and the internet to be free. Those are all complementary to them. Microsoft wants data to be free and software to be expensive. And so, you know, their you know, big advantage, value add, et cetera, is, hey, when it's in Microsoft data, Microsoft Azure data marketplace, you can consume it through Excel. And, you know, it remains to be seen how serious they are about building a data marketplace versus a way to make their software more compelling. But, you know, I think that they're doing really strong work and also doing a really good job, very, you know, kind of that you don't expect from Microsoft at being using open standards, you know, being, you know, good, sensible members of the internet, and really are embracing open standards and making the data compatible with a lot of things. And so it's a really compelling approach. Anyway, I see these as three different ways to scale the same mountain. I think that mountain is real.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you. And that's us out of time, I'm afraid. Thank you very much, Philip. I think there are a number of things there we could have dug into an awful lot deeper, but we didn't have time this time around, so maybe we'll have to do it again. But thank you very much for your time. It's been great talking to you again, and I look forward to seeing where InfoChimps goes next. Thank you.